Why am I hosting? One of you guys should host it. Hello and welcome to the 538 Politics Podcast. I am Micah Cohen. Galen Druk, our normal host, is out today. The 2020 Democratic field continues to grow, which means it's time for some announcement music. In the last few weeks, Colorado Senator Michael Bennet, Montana Governor Steve Bullock, and New York City Mayor Bill de Blasio have all entered the race. Today, we're going to spend some time unpacking Bill de Blasio's theory of the case. Here with me to do that, our editor-in-chief, Nate Silver.
Hey, how are you, Micah?
I'm very good, thank you. And Senior politics writer Claire Malone. Hey, Claire.
Hey, Micah.
In this past month, we've also seen restrictive abortion legislation signed in Georgia, Alabama, and Ohio. Additional bills in Louisiana and Missouri are expected to be signed soon. So on today's show, we're going to look into what's behind the spate of new abortion bills. Has public opinion changed on abortion? And finally, we'll take an early look at the non-presidential races in 2020. Can Democrats win the Senate? Can Republicans win back the House? We'll see what we know so far. But let's begin with Bill de Blasio. Last Thursday, New York City Mayor Bill de Blasio kicked off his presidential run with a video entitled Working People First, where he cast himself as tough, progressive, and a champion for the working class. He took care to point out that as a fellow New Yorker, he knew how to take on Donald Trump, calling him, quote, Con Don, multiple times on Good Morning America.
Guys, we got to think of a good nickname for GMA.
They should have maybe spent a little longer. The nickname already elicited a rebuttal video, though, from the president on Twitter, where he called de Blasio the worst mayor in New York City's history. With that, let's dive into his theory of the case. Claire, where is Bill de Blasio situated within the party?
De Blasio is a progressive, a word that holds little to no meaning anymore as far as being descriptive. I would say de Blasio is kind of the original sort of social justice progressive. I believe he was on John Edwards's 2007 presidential campaign. If people will remember, it was the whole, there are two Americas, so real focus on poverty. When de Blasio came into office in 2013, he was a bit of a surprise winning the New York mayoral election. His whole thing was basically about income inequality, particularly in New York, which obviously has a huge problem with that. So I would say that de Blasio is a progressive. You know, he's on the left. He's not a Bernie Sanders Democratic socialist, in part because I think being mayor of New York and being involved in New York politics imbues you with some sense of pragmatism. Now, we can go into whether or not Bill de Blasio actually wields his power well within New York, and I'm kind of assuming we will since we all live in New York City. But I would say he's kind of a standard left progressive in today's 2019 Democratic Party.
Nate, you agree with that?
Yeah, no, I think that's the right characterization. And as compared to like a lot of people in the primary, both in the left-hand side of the primary and overall, he sort of can point to a track record. There are not a lot of candidates with executive experience, period, in the field.
It's a big city, too.
It's a big city. It's the biggest and bestest city in the world.
Bum,
it's not the biggest. It might be the best.
Best city in the world?
I mean, it's not that controversial a claim. Where else would be better?
Cleveland.
I mean, oh, my God.
Okay. Give me a city. Give me a better city.
I mean, I have certain biases in this. Like, Barcelona is one of my favorite cities.
Barcelona doesn't hold a candle to New York.
I say this with love, but New York could be prettier.
I mean, obviously the cities that New York's better than start with Washington, D.C.
Definitely.
Well, so based on all this, de Blasio should be president?
Okay, no, I have thoughts about that. Because, like, I think that some of his national reputation is hurt by the fact that so many journalists live in New York. I was talking about this weekend with someone who's a lifelong New Yorker. And he was saying, like, you know, actually, de Blasio has been a good mayor in a lot of ways for what people kind of thought they were electing, right? Like, the city now has universal pre-K in a program that's pretty successful. But I think that, and I would call that his kind of marquee program. But de Blasio is, I think, a difficult personality. People who, and by the way, like, there are so many smart, talented, like, dogged city hall reporters in New York that, like, I'm not even going to be pretending to, like, know the ins and outs of New York politics. But I don't think he has a great reputation for interpersonal leadership. He also has a reputation for not being at city hall that much, for like working out at his gym, but also just like not being at the office enough. That's a thing. But I think the really big dynamic that peeves people is the Cuomo dynamic. It's the city-state dynamic, which is New York is the biggest city in America. It has a lot of power in some sense, but in another sense, it is at the whims of a governor who has other constituents. So the big problem with the subways, where Cuomo and the state itself have a lot of, frankly, a lot more power than the mayor does, and the fact that de Blasio hasn't been able to lean on New York state politicians in a way that I think a lot of New Yorkers kind of wish their mayor could, has really gotten a lot of ill will.
So first of all, one piece of context is that de Blasio is someone who, although not overwhelmingly popular, his approval ratings are about break even right now. He was reelected by a very large margin, and what was it, like 37 points or something, and has spent more of his mayoral term being more popular than unpopular. But a lot of that popularity comes from voters who are not white, which of course in New York is a majority of the electorate. And so de Blasio is someone who has never been all that well kind of regarded by like kind of college-educated, highly politically informed white voters. But in an odd way, kind of in the same way that like Joe Biden's had his popularity underrated among Democrats, there is a bit of that with de Blasio as well.
So as someone, I don't actually pay all that close attention to New York politics. I find the kind of de Blasio hate a little confusing. No one's ever really explained it to me in like a succinct, clear way. I mean, you probably just came closest, where it's just like he rubs people the wrong way.
Yes, he rubs people the wrong way, but I really do think we can't underestimate the Cuomo dynamic. Yeah. I mean, essentially, people see de Blasio as being emasculated by Cuomo on a political power play sense, and they see it affecting their daily lives, like I said, and like Nate said.
I mean, there's a sense that he is not a canny political operator. And that kind of ranges from, like, for reasons no one totally understands, he insists on, like, taking...
Going to the gym. In Park Slope. We should clarify.
So why is that?
We should clarify for people who do not live in New York and do not know the geography. That is an hour-long car ride each way. It is insane.
Why does he do it?
To stay in touch with the community. Again, you can make a case. He has implemented a fair number of progressive policies in a big, complicated city. He was reelected twice easily. The approval ratings are no longer great, but they're okay. I mean, like, just kind of on the surface.
He also started kind of a progressive... I mean, when he was elected in 2013, it was a big deal. Like, I did not live in New York at the time and paid attention to that election closely because of the nature of his platform.
So let's start to get into that more as we wrap this up. Grace, who's producing the show, put in the notes like he was progressive kind of before it was cool, which you would think would be an advantage in this primary. But I don't know, do you need to be popular in your kind of home area of representation to win?
Well, he's not popular. He doesn't appear to be off the bat popular with his home state, which I think that's fair that you should be that. But it also doesn't seem like he's getting much traction in early states either. Yeah. Again, you know, he's been like a few times over the past year and a half. And people have, I think, met him with the sort of like, huh, why are you doing this kind of reaction? I think some of the motivations for like he is what, the 23rd person to enter the race. Why is he doing it against reportedly the advice of many of his advisors? I think it goes to, you know, maybe he's bored being the mayor of New York. Maybe he's a relatively young man. He's 2-term mayor of New York. What do you do after that, right? Alexander wept for there were no more worlds to conquer. Like, is that the Bill de Blasio 6'5" syndrome? I don't know. Run for president.
Could be governor.
Mark time. Could be. Well.
Challenge Cuomo and lose by 30 points, probably.
Well, but we're being pretty dismissive of his chances in the primary.
I feel like compared to most people, we're being quite generous.
That says something.
We're discussing his trailblazing as being a progressive executive.
If you do a blind resume test, 2-term mayor of New York, elected on a multiracial constituency with some tangible progressive accomplishments, I mean, that's not crazy. Right? That's not the worst resume. That might be in the top half of resumes, given we have 22 or even less count now of candidates, right? The other candidates who fall in that category, you know, a kind of two-term governor of a swing state like John Hickenlooper you think would be doing better, or Gillibrand you might think would be doing better. So he's not the only one where, like, he seems – where the credentials seem better than the result. But, like – but I don't know. I mean, it's – you're right. It's hard to imagine a scenario. But, like, okay, imagine that Bernie implodes and that, like,
yeah,
for some reason his supporters don't trust Warren because she's a woman.
That's not hard to imagine.
You know?
Well, is de Blasio, like, a good debater? Could you guys see him catching on? I mean, he's run
probably
and
not.
Won a crowded primary before. I guess how much of this does come back to then, you know, a ton of people were passing around that poll result from Quinnipiac that three-quarters of New York City voters didn't think de Blasio should run for president. Does all this dismissiveness come back to that? That if your voters don't think you should do this, then what are you doing?
No, because I'd venture a bet that, like, a lot of constituents of a lot of people running
don't want them to run.
Don't want them to run because yeah. They're like, can you govern us? And by the way, like, how many – he just got real – no, he has 2 years left in his term.
My mayor, our mayor, and one of our senators is running for president. I mean, that's probably not great from a constituent service standpoint.
You felt a dearth of constituent services?
But I feel like, you know, his honor is not really different than other people who are probably fielding some angry calls from constituents saying, like, why are you doing this? You're not going to win. There are 22 other people in the field. Although, and I'm betting that the senators who are running for president are getting fewer of those calls.
I would like...
because it feels more natural.
I would like the mayor and Senator Gillibrand to focus on important priorities for me, such as building a good poker room somewhere in New York. It's pathetic that we have to translate...
I'm sorry, what?
Yes.
let's just mow on past that. Nate, to wrap here, you wrote recently about the influx of, like, straight white men...
yeah.
Jumping into this race. I think we called it on the site a stampede. And de Blasio and Bullock and Bennett all fall in that category. Why do you think we're seeing that?
I think it is like a lot of male ego. I mean, isn't that kind of obvious? I'm not like usually someone who's all like intersectional
obvious.
Or whatever. But like the fact that like you have like literally the last – we don't count Wayne Messam because we think his campaign's not major, right? But like literally 11 candidates in a row or 11 out of 12 after you have this very diverse field are all straight white men. I think there's a sense of like entitlement because honestly like obviously there are exceptions like Bernie and Biden are in that group or whatever. But a lot of the campaigns are like – pretty darn half-assed. And it's a little bit like, I can just kind of show up here when I feel like it, and I'm a straight white guy, and so therefore people must pay attention
but
to me.
But specifically, I think we've talked about this. I'm sure all of these people were considering running for president for the past couple of years, but in maybe other environments they wouldn't have gotten in. But there's no reason not to run if you're that person. There aren't that many barriers to entry, realistically, to this primary, in part because it's not that embarrassing if you lose because,
there's 200
again, 22 other people right. are going to lose, too.
Okay, so let's leave that there, and we're going to move into pulling around abortion, how it's changing or how it's not changing. But first, let me tell you that today's podcast is brought to you by ZipRecruiter. Hiring is challenging, but there's one place you can go where hiring is simple, fast, and smart. A place where growing businesses connect to qualified candidates. That place is ZipRecruiter.com/538, the numbers. ZipRecruiter sends your job to over 100 of the web's leading job boards. And with their powerful matching technology, ZipRecruiter scans thousands of resumes to find people with the right experience and actively invites them to apply to your job. As applications come in, ZipRecruiter analyzes each one and spotlights the top candidates so you never miss a great match. ZipRecruiter is so effective that 4 out of 5 of the employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate through the site within the first day. Right now, listeners can try ZipRecruiter for free at this exclusive web address. ZipRecruiter.com/538. That's ZipRecruiter.com/538. ZipRecruiter.com/538. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire. Today's podcast is also brought to you by Bespoke Post. With their box of awesome, Bespoke Post sends guys only the best stuff every month. They test everything in the box of awesome themselves, from style and grooming goods to barware, cooking tools, and outdoor gear. Every product gets put through the ringer before it gets put inside a monthly box of awesome. To get started, take the quiz at boxofawesome.com. Your answers will help them pick the right box of awesome for you. Each box only costs $45, but has over $70 worth of gear inside. Plus, they release new boxes every month across a ton of different categories. It's free to sign up, and you can skip a month or cancel at any time. Get 20% off your first monthly box when you sign up at boxofawesome.com and enter the code POLITICS at checkout. That's boxofawesome.com, code POLITICS, for 20% off your first box. Okay.
Good job, Mike.
Do you know that I got a breakfast with a client, an advertising client, and they say they actually grade people's live reads on a scale of 1 to 5.
Oh, shit.
Based on how effective the live reads are, and that they find strong correlations between their subjective grades of the live reads and how much product they move.
How many people they drive to the...
Yeah.
How are we doing?
Well, that just made me really nervous. So if you're listening to this...
It's a good data point.
Boxofawesome.com, code POLITICS, and ZipRecruiter.com/538, the numbers, not the letters. Okay. As we mentioned at the top of the show, we've seen a number of abortion restrictions passed at the state level, including in Georgia, Ohio, and Alabama, with Missouri and Louisiana looking to sign similar legislation soon. So let's start off kind of wide scale here in terms of just why is this happening? Do polls show that a public opinion around abortion has changed in some way?
No. I mean, and in fact, the numbers have been remarkably steady, at least in the top line numbers over time.
What is the top line? So there's polling that asks pro-choice, pro-life, right? There's polling that asks... do you think abortion should be legal under any circumstances, mostly legal, mostly illegal, or illegal under all circumstances? I mean, which should we focus on?
It's been interesting to look at the trends and see how relatively steady the number for legal under certain circumstances has been. And I think you've seen in recent years legal under any circumstances rise a bit. I think that legal under certain circumstances probably gets to the heart of how a lot of Americans feel about abortion, which is want it to be legal, but are squeamish, for lack of a better word, with certain later term abortions.
All right. So let me lay out the polling a bit here. Using that scale Claire just referenced, legal only under certain circumstances is consistently been the kind of most popular choice when Gallup has tested this, and it's been that's been consistent for decades. It was at about 50% of people chose that in 2018. Next comes legal under any circumstances. That was 29% most recently. And then illegal in all circumstances polls worst, according to Gallup. That was 18% in 2018. Claire, to your point, the top choice with a majority, a bare majority, but a majority is legal, but with some constraints on there.
Yes. Although we should say that legal under any circumstances has been, in some ways, I would say, like taking away some support from legal under certain circumstances, i.e., I think more people in the column of abortion should be legal. I do think you see a little bit of movement towards people saying it should be legal under any circumstance.
Right. And that's drawing from legal under certain circumstances, but it's all on the sort of
right.
mostly
it's,
legal side.
It's all, yes, it's all on the side of mostly legal. And I do think that that is interesting, especially because, and I would say perhaps this is happening because you are seeing conservatives get very successful at tackling abortion, sort of death by a thousand cuts.
Yeah.
And so I think you probably see a little bit of a reaction in the polling with people who were, oh, I'm for abortion under certain circumstances. Then they see sort of what they might perceive as attacks, and not perceive, they are attacks on Roe v. Wade, and they might say, yikes, right? So I'm going to become pro-abortion under any circumstances.
Yeah, look, or you see, so first of all, the terms pro-life and pro-choice, if you have carefully read 538's journalism, at least since we kind of became if you ignore the days when I was just out on my own, right? So the days when we work with other news organizations like the New York Times or ABC News, you've noticed that we try to avoid using the terms pro-choice and pro-life where possible because they're not very specific. We know what they mean kind of in context, but like they're kind of like – they're sort of loaded terms that are meant to like frame the issue in a certain way, and they're sort of brands. And if you look at the brands, they kind of compete fairly evenly over time, but people can be sensitive to kind of where they perceive the bigger threats to be. If you start to hear noise – or not noise. If you start to hear claims that Democrats are sympathetic to late-term abortion – that might shift people in one direction. If you start to hear claims that, like, Roe v. Wade is under threat, that might shift people in a different direction. One thing that is clear, by the way, is that overturning Roe v. Wade would be unpopular. Right? Even people who are on the fence about abortion, and many people are, I mean, that kind of plurality category of legal under some circumstances has been fairly persistent. But if you were to overturn Roe v. Wade, if you were to, you know, pass bills that are as right-wing as the Alabama bill, then you can cause a backlash potentially.
So let's come back to that backlash idea. But why is it that, so, you know, that Gallup poll found 60% of Americans think first trimester abortion should be legal. 64% said they did not want Roe to be overturned. But yet, when the same poll asked pro-life, pro-choice, it splits basically perfectly evenly, 48-48.
Among the people who say that they want first trimester abortions to be legal.
Separate questions. So they're asking a pool of people, do you think first trimester abortion should be legal? 60% say yes.
Right.
Do you want Roe overturned? 64% say no, right? But among that same group, overall, pro-life, pro-choice, they're divided more equally. In other words, there's not a majority on the pro-choice side.
I think you hear a lot of people say to you when you talk about pro-choice, pro-life, a lot of people make a distinction between being personally pro-life,
yeah,
and I'm using the terms that people generally use, saying personally pro-life, I would not want to get an abortion, I would not want whomever I'm with to get an abortion, but legally I am pro-choice because I understand the reality of, you know, the United States and the world, and that women have always sought to get abortions, and I want abortions to be safe. I think it's a really interesting, you often see Catholic politicians who are Democrats taking this parsing stance. Nancy Pelosi is someone who I believe has identified herself as personally pro-life, but she is a establishment Democrat through and through. She is pro-choice in her political stance. And I think that that's something that's become, I'm trying to think of the last Catholic Democratic politician on the national level to be pro-life. And I believe it might have been Mario Cuomo. So it's an interesting, but I do think while that might not be a tenable position for a lot of national Democratic Party figures, now there are probably people on the state level for sure. I do think it's a nuanced position that I think a lot of people still have, where they might say, I'm personally against it, but I think it should be legal. And you might see those people limit themselves to, well, I only think first trimester abortion,
right,
should be legal, or only medically necessary second or third trimester abortions.
Yeah, and on the pro-life side, I mean, most people, I think including of most people that call themselves pro-life, I think they would support exceptions for rape, incest, life of the mother. And so if people kind of hear pro-life, they think, okay, that means that, like, in these extreme cases, it's allowed, but otherwise not, right? They don't think of it necessarily as being, like, the Alabama version of it. And with pro-choice, think, okay, that means that, like, you may personally object to it, but you want the choice to be available with some restrictions, though, right, that you can't do it, like, after X date. So the minute kind of people begin to kind of see the pro-life and pro-choice terms and more extreme terms, and that might shift them in the other direction, I guess. I mean, like, none of this is like, I don't want it to make it seem like any of this is inconsistent or incoherent, right? If you kind of ask the three-way question, complete rights to an abortion under any circumstances, no abortion whatsoever, or somewhere in between, then a fairly large plurality and often a majority in most polls are in that somewhere in between category. And so if you try to, like, slice up that three-way divide into two ways instead, then it gets sensitive to, like, question wording and kind of how people perceive what these different terms mean.
First, a fact check. Mario Cuomo was legally, I think, pro-choice, but pretty vocal about being personally pro-life. So it's been a while. I will say, though, like, just to talk more about why people are so ambivalent or so on some level, maybe doesn't the numbers don't make sense. The conversation around when does life begin is so interesting. And obviously, the Catholic conceit of the idea is that it begins basically right away, right? Sperm meets egg. That's when life begins. Then I think you have all these sort of evolving conversations of, well, when does the fetus become viable outside the womb? And is it not, are there sort of almost sliding scales of humanness, right? Which is, yes, this is some sort of separate living being, but when does its humanness equal or outweigh the mother, right?
Yeah.
You know, and I think that that's a really interesting kind of philosophical discussion. That so often top line political debate cannot handle, because by necessity, people need to sort of shrink these views down to a postcard or a placard in some ways, right? It's pro-choice, pro-life, right? But I think real people have these really complicated thought processes over the beginning of human life and pregnancy. And, you know, I think women in particular, it is incredibly personal, you know, for a lot of people, struggle, not for everyone. But I think it's certainly something that people, it's not abstract for people who have wombs. So it's an interest, I think that the numbers sort of belie that in their confusion.
So do you guys think that's how this debate and process will play out, or will it play out
with nuance?
Yeah. Here's an example. You know, Georgia, which passed one of these quote-unquote heartbeat bills, which would ban abortions after 6 weeks. During the debate on that, the Atlanta Journal-Constitution conducted a poll that showed 49% of people opposed the bill and 44% approved of the bill.
Mm-hmm.
Again, this is a bill which effectively outlaws abortions, right? Many women don't even know they're pregnant at 6 weeks.
Right. That's a good tidbit for our male listeners here.
Right. Yeah, yeah. Yet in the same poll, respondents were 3-1 against overturning Roe.
Mm-hmm.
So in other words, the opposition to overturning Roe far outpaced the opposition to this bill, mm-hmm. which effectively overturned Roe, right? Not literally, but in effect in the state. So in other words, I think what you're seeing there is partisan identities kicking in. My team is pushing this bill. I'm for the bill. Will that be how this plays out? Or is the Alabama thing, as Nate was sort of, I think, hinting at, fringe enough and extreme enough in terms of not including exceptions for rape and incest, life of the mother, that
it does include it does include a life of the mother exemption.
Oh, I'm sorry.
But does not include rape or incest. The honest answer is probably some partisan push. But the reason why I made that note for male listeners is part of me also wonders if people don't quite understand the mechanics of it. And I'm not saying this to be condescending, but to say, you know, some of those people who said, yeah, I think this bill is fair, but I don't want to see Roe overturned, might say a woman's menstrual cycle is generally around 4 weeks, actually around 28 days, precisely. And so, you know, that's enough of a cushion for her to realize she's pregnant. She's got a couple weeks. She grapples with the decision. She makes a decision, right? Okay, like that seems like a reasonable timeline to me.
Yeah.
I think that there might be some people within those numbers who might say that seems fair. But then you get into all the things that people continually are bringing up, which is a lot of women don't know they're pregnant by that point. They might not realize that the missed period is a pregnancy. If they do know right away when they miss their period, well, they might not have enough money together or time together to get the abortion. So I do think that some of this seems like you might not think that hard right? When someone's asking you that survey question, and think about the logistics and the mechanics of what that 6 weeks actually means.
Nate, let's get into like the wider political context of this. Obviously, we just came out of an election that was labeled the year of the woman, and we're heading into an election for the presidency. How do you see this kind of this debate fitting in that or not?
I mean, so although the top line numbers on abortion have remained similar for a long time, it's become much more partisan over time. That kind of in the 70s, there was almost no partisan split on views on abortion. Obviously, under Reagan, under both of the Bushes, the kind of moral majority, religious right, whatever you want to call it, began to see abortion as a wedge issue. And likewise, Democratic groups have begun to see a pro-choice stance as a wedge issue, and both sides use it a lot. And that'll probably be how it is again this year. I mean, look, I don't think either side is lacking for wedge issues. You know, and we did see like a lot of evangelicals kind of turn out for Trump in big numbers. And I don't think, you know, and we saw like lots of women turn out for Democrats in very big numbers. And so I don't know. Politically, it's kind of like if the court actually takes steps to overturn Roe versus Wade before the next election or any point afterward, that's a giant story. Otherwise, I think it's like, you know, maybe one of the more important issues to lots of people, but you're in an environment where all these issues have been activated and people already have 10 or 20 or 30 reasons to vote the way they do. And it probably encourages kind of party line voting.
I think the thing is, though, that abortion is a wedge issue to a lot of liberals. I don't want to say it feels retro, but I think that on the liberal schema, things like income inequality, the idea of sort of radically rehauling the financial institutions and then, you know, American institutions has like really risen in prominence. Not to say that abortion isn't still an important issue on the left, but I do think that it's kind of like, for a blunt phrasing, like fallen out of vogue a little bit. Whereas on the conservative side of things, it's really maintained its prominence. And now I think with you've had people on the left consistently saying, look, the conservative right is really, really smart about litigating this stuff. People need to be vigilant. And I just think it's almost this Alabama bill honestly feels like an interesting groundswell on the left because I don't think a lot of you periodically see this, right? By the way, we should say the Alabama law isn't going to be enforced, right? It's not an enforceable law, and it was written that way as a potential challenge to Roe to go through the court system. But I do think you saw a pretty interesting groundswell on the left, and I wasn't sure up until, you know, this past weekend exactly, like, whether or not abortion was going to be a huge issue in the 2020 election. Personally, I didn't necessarily see it going there. Now, it still might not. Kirsten Gillibrand certainly hopes so, I think. You know, there was an interesting Shane Goldmacher piece in The Times saying she's really going to, you know, her campaign has been sort of flagging. She might use this issue as a way to get a little bit more support. But I didn't necessarily see abortion as being a marquee 2020 issue. Perhaps naive on my part, but to me, there were so many things happening on the left besides this sort of kind of like old debate that we've been having in this country. And there are lots of new debates that are happening that seem to be kind of the, you know, catching the magpie eye of the populace.
What's interesting is that the Supreme Court was one of these issues that you mentioned, Claire, where it seemed to activate people on the right more than people on the left, right? And I think after Gorsuch and after Kavanaugh got there, I think you started to see some people on the left, as you were saying, sort of be like, hey, we got to get our shit together on this issue. What's ironic, though, is that ultimately is what's behind a lot of this, right? Anti-abortion activists are looking around saying, okay, we have, we think, five justices on the Supreme Court who are against abortion. Let's try to go after Roe. Some of these laws are going after Roe in a trying to sort of chip away at it way. The Alabama law is going at it in a let's upend the whole thing way. And I think you're right that the Alabama law is unlikely to succeed, but these other chipping away laws might work better. But I guess part of what I would argue maybe is that if the Alabama law is what's at the center of the debate, then I do think maybe it activates Democrats more than this issue has in the past, as opposed to, you know, I don't think we saw these, you know, Republicans have been trying to chip away at this and successfully chipping away at abortion access for years, and it hasn't done all that much to activate Democrats, I don't think.
I think that's true, in part perhaps because there is this sort of interesting, as we see in the numbers, conflict that people do have.
You do see, so in contrast to gay marriage, where you see very, very big generational splits, you don't see that as much on abortion. That generally depends on how you phrase the question. Millennials are slightly more pro-abortion rights or pro-choice, if you want to use that term. But it's not a large spread, especially given that millennials are more liberal in general. It might even be that controlling for how liberal you are, that age, that older voters who remember kind of Roe versus Wade are more inclined to defend abortion rights. But yeah, it is complicated. You know, I think you see more people who split their opinions now on abortion versus gay marriage. And so I think you can't just kind of lump it into like a generic kind of cultural issue. I think it has its own trajectory, and that trajectory is actually kind of potentially very much up in the air given kind of all the threads in American politics. And by the way, you know, we can't also discount the possibility that a Supreme Court justice will die or retire before the next election. If you're going to have lifetime offices, something I think is not a good idea, then we need to consider the possibility that could happen coinciding with the next election.
Okay, let's leave that there and move on to the non-presidential races of 2020, the House and the Senate. But before we do that, let me tell you that this episode is brought to you by Quip. Just 2 minutes twice a day can help pave the way to a healthier mouth and mind. People often brush too hard, and some electric toothbrushes are too abrasive, but not Quip. With its sensitive sonic vibration, Quip effectively cleans while being gentle on sensitive gums. Plus, Quip makes it easy to stay committed to your oral health by delivering new brush heads automatically on a dentist-recommended schedule every 3 months for just $5. Quip is one of the first electric toothbrushes accepted by the American Dental Association. They're backed by over 25,000 dental professionals, and they have thousands of verified 5-star reviews. That's why over 1 million happy, healthy mouths love Quip. Quip starts at just $25, and if you go to getquip.com/538 right now, you can get your first refill pack for free. That's your first refill pack for free at getquip.com/538. Okay, we spend a lot of time on this show discussing the 2020 race for president, but we felt like it was time to check in on the other big battles taking place that year, namely the Senate and the House. So in 2020, Republicans will be defending 22 seats in the Senate to the Democrats' 12, but Democrats hope to flip the Senate might be more of an uphill battle than those numbers suggest. Nate, what do Democrats need in order to take back the Senate, and how likely do you think it is that they'll get it?
If they were to win the presidency, then they would need a net of 3 seats to get a 50-50 Senate. The net part is important because Democrats are defending some of their own seats, including Doug Jones's seat in Alabama, where Doug Jones won in Alabama because he had an opponent named Roy Moore who was accused of preying on young girls, which even by the standards of a really Republican state was a bridge too far. And even then, Doug Jones only won by a point or something. And even then, it was only in a really blue overall environment, as we would see later on that year. That cycle of 2018 was a good year for Democrats. So the question is, do they need 3 or 4? Or if they don't win the presidency, then potentially 5. And I don't know. You can definitely point to enough races where they have a shot. Looking at my chart right here, that would include probably the most obvious cases are Colorado, where Cory Gardner has probably been too pro-Trump for that state on too many issues. The state's become more blue. Arizona, where McSally was appointed the replacement for John McCain, although Kyle served in an interim basis. And she lost last year to Kyrsten Sinema. You'll probably have a vigorous Democratic candidate there. So those are the first two that are kind of the lowest hanging fruit.
Not Maine?
Mark Kelly, by the way. Isn't he the Arizona?
The Democrat.
You have Gallego Democratic running campaign. Kelly. So you'll have a competitive Senate primary, actually, in Arizona. And Colorado, though Hickenlooper's not running, there are plenty of are Democrats coming through the woodwork in Colorado? And
that, maybe he will.
Well, Hickenlooper, yeah. Yeah. Or
you got to have a plan B, you know?
Maybe Michael Bennett with one T will run for the other Senate seat for no particular reason. So Maine, Susan Collins' approval ratings are still pretty decent. Depends on what poll you look at. They've taken a hit from where they were very, very strong before. But she's obviously one of the people that you think would be among the more likely targets. North Carolina, Tillis won by a narrow margin over Kay Hagan 6 years ago. North Carolina has become a state that has often been kind of a tease for Democrats, but sometimes, as Republicans have learned with Florida, for example, or Pennsylvania, although beating Bill Nelson in Florida, sometimes those teases actually go your way once in a while. Iowa, Joni Ernst, who is someone who is seen as a very capable politician, her approval ratings were like a little bit more mediocre than I thought intuitively based on her kind of strong national profile. So she's someone who in a strong year Democrats could beat. Then you get some longer shots, Georgia, Alaska, Texas, Mississippi, where Cindy Hyde-Smith is a very weak incumbent. So, you know, you got Lindsey Graham down there in South Carolina.
Okay, now we're.
You got Mitch McConnell in Kentucky.
Claire, are those...
Who's very unpopular.
Among those, you know, which are you watching or which do you feel like are going to be the most ripe for a Democratic pickup? Do you also think Colorado and Arizona? Are you?
I do, just because of the environments of those states. It's the boring answer. Also, just we mentioned Mark Kelly is likely going to run against McSally. He is the astronaut husband of Gabby Giffords. So he's somewhat, you know, that's a family with obviously a strong profile. I think a lot of sort of, they have a lot of emotional resonance. I think that's a really good candidate for Democrats. That's a really interesting candidate. And then, yeah, I think Colorado, I don't know who's going to run in Colorado, but I do think, you know, I don't know the contours of what kind of Democrat will run, but yeah, it just seems like that state is pretty ripe. I mean, I'll also be watching Alabama. I profiled Doug Jones last year in part to kind of talk about like what he had to do as the first Democratic senator from Alabama in a long, long time during the couple of years he had until re-election to sort of win again. I think it's obviously going to be a really difficult proposition. You see a lot of Republicans who are sort of, you know, just champing at the bit to run against him. Maybe having, I think, you know, in some ways his best, like, you know, the best kind of person to have on the presidential ballot is someone who could really turn out the Democratic constituency in Alabama. He saw a lot of support from black areas of the state. So, you know, maybe minority candidate or who knows, maybe Joe Biden, as we've said, you know, strong among black voters. Maybe that'll do it. So that's a race that I just think is fascinating for its historical implications and just sort of the screwiness of Alabama Republican politics, in part because that state hasn't seen a lot of challenges to the Republican hierarchy because it's such a strongly partisan leaning state.
Are there other Democratic held Senate seats that you think they should be worried about?
New Mexico is an open seat race. So those can always be a bit unpredictable potentially. You know, New Hampshire has a race. I mean, let's put it like this, right? If you had a really good Republican environment, then all these kind of states where you have purple seats with Democratic incumbents could become vulnerable.
So that's like Michigan, Minnesota, New Hampshire, right?
Yeah. And maybe New Mexico, where you have a retirement open seat. You know, I think that's the least likely scenario between having a good Democratic year or a neutral year. And, I mean, look, in some ways it's a little anticlimactic. I don't think there is enough opportunities for Democrats to win the Senate in a neutral year. Just by, like, even though they have more opportunities than the GOP does, in a neutral year where you don't have a wind at your back, you probably lose Doug Jones's seat, and then you have to win four. If you win the presidency, you have to win five otherwise, right? If you have a good Democratic year, we did an exercise in Silver Bullet Points, my weekly column on last week.
Shameless plug.
Trying to evaluate the effect of both the political environment and the strength of the candidate. If you're in an environment that was as strong as it was last year for Democrats, meaning about 7 or 8 points more left of center, which there's no particular reason to think we'll have, but could happen if you go into a recession, for example, or Trump gets approval range dips into the 30s or something, right? That they probably have enough. They probably will find a way to eke out four wins-ish, and then maybe you can afford to lose Doug Jones, or maybe he wins anyway. He did win again in that blue environment the first time, but not a slam dunk. I mean, again, we saw these races can be quirky. We saw Democrats lose a race in Florida that kind of on paper they shouldn't have lost. An incumbent, no matter how strong a candidate Rick Scott was, in a year as blue as 2018 was, you're not supposed to lose that race in Florida.
Can I ask about some of these like seats that are rated solid R right now? Let's just play hypothetical. I mean, what if, okay, Tennessee is an open seat, leans R. What if someone like Phil Bredesen is like the former Democratic governor of Tennessee who ran against Marsha Blackburn last year? What if he says, I'm going to do it again? And, you know.
He lost by a lot, though.
That's the thing is, if he was going to do it, he would have done it. In 2018 was the time to do it, right?
Guys, John Cornyn is running in Texas. Could someone else besides Beto O'Rourke turn Texas blue?
Well, that's the thing about
I mean, but honestly, I'm having a conversation about what are the wild cards. I mean, I wrote a Senate wild cards piece before the Senate cycle started.
Which turned out to be pretty prescient.
Yeah. And so what I'm saying is, what are the wild cards here? Some of it's recruitment. Some of it, someone might drop out. Someone might die, you know? But I don't think it's a... I asked the Texas turning blue question slightly facetiously, but given that there was some sort of historical precedent, maybe that's a wild card. I don't know. I'm just sort of spitballing here.
Yeah, you have open Republican seats in Kansas, Tennessee, and Wyoming. Of the three, Kansas is a tiny bit interesting. You did have Democrats perform well in Kansas last year. They won the governorship and I believe two House seats there.
I have a good wild card. Keep going, Nate. Sorry.
Montana. But look, a lot of these are cases where you would need both a really blue year and a really good candidate, and even then it might not be enough.
Okay. Ben Sasse gets primaried in Nebraska by a super, super conservative person, a very moderate Democrat runs. That's a wild card.
Okay, but I feel like if you guys are telling me that in order to even have a chance at taking the Senate, Democrats need a 2018 level political environment and Trump's approval rating to be in the 30s, then that's a tall, tall order, right? Wild cards or no wild cards.
He's at 41 or 42 right now, right? So it's not like radically.
Yeah, but it like barely moves.
I mean, if you look at generic ballot polls right now, they're not the most high quality polls to a lot of online polls. Although online polls are fine, so I don't mean to disparage, but like it's not like the robust mix you'd have later on the cycle. They show Democrats up like 4 or 5 points on average, having won the popular vote by 8.6, almost 9 last year. So that is tamped down from where it was. And, you know, would that be enough? Maybe that is actually the middle ground where, like, having, like, a really strong set of candidates would help. But I don't know. You know, one thing people talk about, like, oh, well, Beto and Stacey Abrams, they could really help in those states, right? Let's remember Beto and Stacey Abrams were not people that were regarded as particularly strong candidates ahead of time. You know, I thought Beto was, I was going to say kind of a joke, but not really, because like to have a member of Congress give up their seat to run is something. That's a decently qualified candidate. Or Stacey Abrams kind of, you know, running the Democratic delegation and I believe the state house in Georgia. These are decent credentials to put on the line, but no one would have thought that they were especially strong candidates to kind of prove their mettle over time. And so I don't know. I find like the recruitment story a little bit overdone, in part because, like, for a lot of reasons. One reason being that, like,
Claire's skeptical.
Yeah, I am.
Okay, so we in Silver Bullet Points, right? What chance...
Claire, have you not read Silver Bullet Points? What is wrong with you?
You know what?
What chance,
I've skimmed it.
What chance does Steve Bullock actually have to win his Senate race, right? If Steve Bullock came to me and I was being incentivized to be accurate and not to flatter him, I would probably say I think you have in the neighborhood of a 20% chance of winning that seat, assuming the Republican Daines is running again, if not a little bit higher. But, you know, you have a 1 in 5 shot. If you do that, it would be really helpful to Democrats because probably no one else is going to win that seat. But 4 to 5 times, you're going to lose. You're going to be Phil Bredesen, right? People will say, well, you know, it turns out that blah, blah, blah. Maybe he wasn't as good as he thought. You know, do you really want that or not? I don't know. I mean, what happens is that when you have signs of a really big wave year, then people say, screw it, I'll join the party. This is fun. And their chances go up, right? And so, and by the way, we are still pretty early. It's May 20th, 2019. The election is November 3rd. By the way, thank God it's the 3rd. It's like early this year.
It's within a range of like 5 days.
It can be, Micah, every day matters, man. One more day of sanity.
Okay.
One more day of relaxation and enjoyment between the election and Christmas.
Let's end this podcast. Let's end this talking about the House, which I feel like not a lot of people are talking about.
Burning down the House.
Do Republicans have a chance to win back the House in 2020?
I mean, yeah, obviously.
How much of a chance?
According to prediction markets.
I don't care about prediction markets. I want to know what you think, Nate Silver.
I think they have around a 1 in 3 chance of winning the House back, which is about what prediction markets think.
Oh, wow. Claire?
Who am I to contradict prediction markets? And
by the way,
Nate Silver.
Okay. Who, by the way, we should have had an Australia segment. Can we have an Australia?
Absolutely not.
Podcast this week.
If we could do a live show in Australia.
I would not go.
Wait, are you kidding?
Absolutely not.
Why?
Because if you go to Australia, you're mandated to stay there at least 2 weeks because it's such a pain in the ass to get there.
Yeah, but it's nice there.
You know what? I have a lot of other places I want to go before I go to Australia.
In any event. Okay, so look.
On the one hand. It's pretty good. It's higher than I thought you'd say.
What do you think,
Micah?
Well,
look.
1 in 5.
You're Democrats just saying that to contradict Nate.
No.
Okay.
Well, it's like, let me put it this way. When I was trying to prep for this, I was Googling and reading about Democrats' chances of winning the Senate, and I was Googling and trying to read about Republican chances of winning the House, and there's far, far, far less about the latter than about the former.
So here's the basic argument. Being an incumbent doesn't matter very much anymore. That's one reason why Democrats were able to win so many seats last year, even though a lot of seats are gerrymandered or there's a lot of partisan sorting. The flip side to that is that if you were an elected first-term incumbent in a D+8 or D+9 year, and all of a sudden we flip back, let's say it's a neutral year,
yeah,
or even a D+3 year, right? Then your incumbency advantage might not be enough to overcome that. And Democrats did kind of explore, in part because they raised so much money, they went pretty deep in exploring the landscape, and they kind of won most of the seats they could have won. There's probably some low-hanging fruit in Texas. Yeah, if you want to go more granularly, then it's probably a little early to do that. I think Democrats would say, boy, we have 4 or 5 seats in Texas that we wish we had contested more in 2018 that were closer than we thought they would be. There are a bunch of cases where state courts have ruled GOP gerrymandered maps illegal, and so you'll see the Supreme Court rule on those. There's some upside to Democrats in states like Ohio and Michigan if those maps are thrown out potentially. But, you know, you also had last time around like a lot of GOP incumbents that were caught kind of sleeping and napping.
Really? I feel like they had a way heads up.
If they'd been reading 538.com, they would have, right? But if they were listening to...
But Nate, your overall point is that Democrats who won a net of 40 seats in 2018 went pretty deep into Republican territory, and so now they have to defend that?
Now they have to defend it in an environment that probably won't be as good.
Claire, when speaking to kind of what the Republican strategy would be to try to take back the House, the NRCC chairman, Representative Tom Emmer of Minnesota, said, quote, freedom or socialism, that's the choice in 2020. Do you feel like that'll be an effective kind of messaging strategy?
In some ways, if like Sanders gets the nomination, yes. Because that'll be kind of on the brain, right?
Yeah.
I'm guessing that they're going to try to use AOC as sort of that kind of boogeyman, you know?
Boogeywoman.
That's a good for name for like a riot girl band, Boogeywoman.
Boogeywoman.
It could work. I mean, you know, it's, you know, the whole like, it's a free country kind of thing. It could be. We can see.
That's not how that expression is used.
Can I, you know what?
Republicans, it's a free country. It's a free country.
Wait, can I make an observation? I don't know why I've been thinking about this lately, but like, I used to use that phrase all the time when I was younger, right? Like, that would be like a retort that you'd have to someone. It's a free country. Can I sit here? It's a free country. Can I use your pencil? It's a free country.
That sounds obnoxious.
I know, but like, we said it all the time when we were kids. Is that still a thing?
I think so. I think people say that.
But when was the last time you said that?
I think maybe you and I have just matured and we're not so sort of passive aggressive anymore. Although Nate accused me of being passive aggressive this morning.
You are.
I wasn't.
I know you are. Oh, that's even making it worse.
I really wasn't.
Yes. You were also like cut this.
Can we ask your audience?
I'll read. Okay, I would be curious if I'm. Do I come off as passive aggressive on this show? I would not want that.
People are nice and aren't going to say that.
I would never want you guys to.
Nate and I
like
just come off as aggressive. Yeah, I think. Just red blooded Americans, aggressive, aggressive. All right. Let me go back to my actual answer, which is I kind of think it depends on who is the Democratic nominee. Because it could be like a kind of an effective.
Yeah.
Like, especially if some of these, like, let's not forget that some of the candidates have said, I want to change the Electoral College. Like, I want to rejigger all these things. A lot of institutional change that I think a lot of Americans are kind of uncomfortable with. I'm not sure if the AOC boogeywoman will be sort of stale by then. So it remains to be seen. But, you know, Republicans didn't really get to trot out their Bernie Sanders socialist attack in 2016. So maybe it does work.
Let's also remember a lot of the places where Democrats gained ground in 2018 were not in presidential swing states. So they won a lot of seats in California, in New York, New Jersey, won a couple of in Texas and could win more. None of those are, except maybe Texas, likely to be competitive at the presidential level. And so like, so you do have like a little bit of an incongruity between like where might a candidate be strong in terms of the Electoral College versus where would they help Democrats running for the House.
Well, so let's end just on that. We only have a couple minutes here. How much does the Democrats' ability to win the Senate or the Republicans' ability to win the House depend on who Democrats nominate in 2020? Is there a lot of variation there or is it like kind of a marginal effect either way?
I mean, that kind of gets into the much broader question of like, how much does a presidential candidate matter?
But a lot, right? Because the straight ticket voting has increased. There's much less split ticket voting. Wouldn't you expect it to have a big effect? Claire said yes, but in a whisper.
Yeah. I mean, this gets into the E word, Micah, electability. And then like, I know, but it's also, you know, maybe people would actually say, okay, I think Bernie Sanders is too far left, but I'll make a distinction here and vote for my moderate seeming first term congresswoman. I don't know. The marginal effect between like who would vote for Biden but not for Bernie or vice versa, that's already somewhat marginal, right? And so it's kind of like comparing a marginal effect against another marginal effect.
What if that became though like a presidential, like a high level argument of a presidential candidate?
I'll bring the Senate with me.
Yeah. Like, what if you just, like, if you were trying to, I don't know, win over, like, second ballot people or something, that where you were just, that's like a valid.
No, there was
argument.
Some of that. I remember some of that being used against Trump in 2016, too, that, oh, he would decimate us down yeah. ballot by the Republicans. Okay. Let's leave it there. Thank you, Nate.
Thank you, Micah.
Thank you, Claire.
Thanks, Micah. Good job at the hosting shenanigans.
I would say it was my pleasure, but I didn't really enjoy it, so
yeah,
I won't say
you're
that.
Sweating bullets.
My name is Micah Cohen. Grace Lynch and Tony Chow are in the control room. Special thanks to them for helping make up for Galen's absence. Galen, come back soon. You can get in touch by emailing us at podcast@538.com or Nate Silver at 538.com. That's not his email. You can also, of course, tweet at us with questions or comments. If you're a fan of the show, leave us a rating or a review in the Apple Podcast Store or tell someone about us. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you soon.